Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, episode 64, a podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
And I'm Jerry. In today's show, we'll be talking about IIS.
We'll also have a brief discussion about immutable infrastructure.
And we'll discuss Matrix and how it can talk to other platforms. And now we get on with the show.
Welcome to episode 64 of the Admin Admin Podcast. Without further ado, what's everyone been up to?
Well, I've been playing with SQL clustering quite a bit the last couple of weeks, getting my head around it, different versions, because it's really complicated depending on what kind of version you have, like if it's a standard enterprise, and there's a lot of price difference. And the customer I've been working with had not brought the enterprise version, so it was the standard version, and it caused me a big headache. But I think I'm going to talk about that in another section. I'm going to go and get some notes and make sure we do it properly. The other thing I've been doing was that it was a bit ironic, actually, because listening to the Security Now podcast about Steve Gibbons, when he's actually about deprecating a TLS1, was actually I was dealing with a customer who had to, for GDPR, they were still, they were only serving SSL 2.3 and TLS 1, not even 1.1. And they were running a website. And when people were connecting, because they were disabling 1.0 in their browser, they couldn't connect to their site. So this is on an IIS box, which is the internet, which is the Windows web server. Mm-hmm. So I had basically enable 1.1 and 1.2 and disable SSL 2, SSL 3, and TLS 1. I was using the SSL Lab website you can go to, and you can put your site in, and it will basically just tell you what you're presenting out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've used that.
And it's interesting, I found another, you have basically some reg keys you have to put in on your server, registry keys to enable and disable them. And annoyingly, there was conflicting information about what it was doing, depending on what Microsoft article you read. So I found this interesting piece of software called IIS Crypt, and it is an application you can store on your server, and it will basically write the keys for you in the registry to enable and disable it, depending on what protocol you want to disable. And then once I've done that, annoyingly, it wouldn't run on the server I wanted it to, because you had to install .NET 4, which I didn't want to do on my live production server. So I basically used my demo suite to install it, see what registry keys it made, and then export those registry keys. And then I could then re-import them back on my live server in the downtime to do it. So, yeah, so what's everyone else been up to?
Well, I've been looking a bit at Kubernetes and CoreOS. So CoreOS is generally what is used to run Kubernetes. And the reason for that, I think, is it's designed from the ground up as a sort of an immutable system. So what I mean by that is if you reboot the thing, it comes up with a specific configuration. It's designed to just run in the way it's configured. And if you want to have a different configuration, you rewrite it, and then I guess, well, you can reboot it, or you can just rebuild the server or the VM or whatever, and you have a slightly differently configured OS. The way that it's configured is it uses a YAML file, or what you configure it using a YAML file. Then you have to do some process to turn that into JSON, and then that's what the server itself reads when it boots. That process is called ignition. So there's a few sort of different, I guess, marketing terms around it. But yeah, it's pretty cool. It's a very strange way of working with the server, though, I've found. But it takes a bit of getting used to. But once you do, it's quite cool.
So is that the actual OS, how you configure the OS?
Yeah, I mean, you can SSH into it, and it's got, you know, text editor. Yeah, it's got Vim on it and so on. But as soon as you reboot it, it comes back up in the way that it was originally configured.
So one of the things that I found when I was looking at immutable infrastructures is it definitely kind of is part of the whole cattle and pets conversation, where, you know, pets are like the old the sort of servers that we all cut our teeth on when we were, you know, doing operation stuff. You know, so a server would be built from a CD and you'd stand it up and you'd install half a dozen applications and you'd go in and you'd manually crank the installation of all the different applications and stuff. And obviously the CATL side of things is more using automation tools like Ansible or Puppet or Chef or whatever to provision a box. And really kind of the next stage of that is your Kubernetes, like you said, your immutable infrastructure. I think you used to work on another customer as well where they did immutable infrastructure with dev packages, didn't they?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, effectively, you know, you supply your config and in form of a Linux packaging format. And what that packaging format does is put files in a certain place and then it can run sort of arbitrary scripts before and after that process. So yeah, they were kind of making changes to their infrastructure in a sort of planned way. So they, at any point, you can see exactly what state each box is in. And if a config is completely different, you can choose to just completely rebuild the box.
Yeah. So I know that the kind of the brief kind of couple of passes I've had at looking at Docker, which is kind of a very similar technology, but a different way of being implemented.
Yeah, well, I mean, Docker images are immutable. If you want to make a change to a Docker image, it becomes a different image, and then you run it and it becomes a container. So I guess everyone is thinking in that way now. For better or worse, you know, there's pluses and minuses. But I think if you configure a machine, you can configure that machine at boot.
Mm.
And that takes out any guesswork in bigger distributed systems about how things are configured.
Well, it's not even about that sort of thing. Yes, you're right. That is one of the benefits to it. The main thing that I see with those sorts of things, though, is it's more in the fact that you are repeatably building the same environment. So it doesn't matter if you're building it in AWS or Azure or DigitalOcean or wherever else it is, you end up building your environment or Vagrant on your local machine.
Hmm.
By using these immutable infrastructures, you're building in exactly the same way on every environment you build. So it doesn't matter if you might have some driver differences between a VirtualBox and a AWS or between DigitalOcean and Azure. But realistically, once you've got your base level for your operating system up, everything else should be the same after that point.
Yeah. And you can even sort of abstract away those differences between for instance, the different cloud providers that you were mentioning, AWS, Azure, in something like Vagrant. I mean, Vagrant does it really well. It just happens to do it really well. It's more of a tool meant for sort of prototyping stuff, but it does actually work. I mean, I think it works quite well for describing larger bits of infrastructure, to be honest.
So one of the things that I need to do in the very near future is start to look at Terraform. And the reason why I need to do that is because it's written by the same people who write Vagrant. But it's a way of... So as I understand it, and I still need to really properly have a look at this, Terraform is a way of saying, of having a plan stage and a deploy stage. So the plan stage actually goes away and asks your infrastructure, whether that's Azure, AWS, whatever.
It talks to the API of the infrastructure provider.
But so it checks, you know, is your VPC or whatever the equivalent infrastructure pieces, is that stood up and is it configured the way you want it to? And if it's not configured the way you want it to, provision the thing that you want it to provision, like and likewise for load balancers and virtual machines. And it's not just for the IaaS, the infrastructure as a service, it will also work with platform as a service and even function as a service.
Basically, it has objects in it, or primitives, if you like. You can think of it as a programming language, really, or a domain-specific language. And it has different objects for different providers. So it doesn't abstract away, you know, So an instance in Azure is a different object from an instance in AWS or DigitalOcean or wherever. But you could probably write quite similar code, or write a bit of code for one provider and then translate it to another. But basically what it's doing is going away and talking to this provider's API, and then finding out what's already there and finding out what changes need to be made. But that can even go down as far as, you change, for instance, you change a property of an instance, like the amount of memory that's in it. And so it'll then make a decision on whether it has to rebuild the whole instance. So if you change the amount, if you make an instance, actually, I'm not sure you can do that. And I think you just have to ask for an instance of a certain size. Then that kind of lends itself towards immutability, because then you have to define an image parameter. So in AWS, that'd be an AMI, Amazon Machine Image. And then it will put that onto the image as it builds it. And, when it comes up, your server will be running. So what I mean by lending itself to immutability is that you have to build that image in advance if you want to rebuild a server. But then you can also plug that into CI pipeline, where you've made a change to your configuration, your infrastructure as code configuration. Then that's triggered a build of an image, and hopefully some testing in there as well.
Mm.
And then it spits out an image at the end, and it sits there and ready to be deployed by Terraform.
Right.
Just as an example.
So would you... Core OS, Jerry. So are you running that on physical hardware, or is that in the cloud somewhere?
It's on a VM. The place where I'm currently working has its non-live environments. So it has live in UAT and AWS, and the non-live stuff is actually in the server room in the office, which is not that common these days. But the guy was saying that they would have liked to install OpenStack, but they didn't have time. So they've got this, they're actually using Pixie booting of VMs,
mm-hmm.
Using Ansible.
That's quite cool.
Yeah. It works pretty well, actually, still. I used Pixie boot on physical servers many years ago, and it would have been great if I could have configured that using Ansible at the time, but unfortunately it had yet to be invented. So... but I mean, in a nutshell, CoreOS is it's a different way of looking at servers. I ended up not using Kubernetes on it, but just bringing up a Docker host, a Docker container. But the way you do that is using systemd, so you just basically define the systemd unit in your config, just pipe it in as a multi-line thing, and then that's how you start your Docker containers. And you can use Ansible to configure that YAML, and use Ansible, the loops and things that you get, the sort of programming bits of Ansible for that as well. So it's quite handy.
So you're saying that you basically boot off your Pixie boot image.
You Pixie boot it so that's how they build all their servers in their non-live environments, including the CoreOS servers. But the CoreOS servers have this particular way of starting up, whereby they read this JSON file as it's being converted as they boot. So you can make a change to the configuration, and as long as it's on the web server, the next time the machine reboots, it will read that configuration and apply that to itself.
Sounds very cool. And who owns, or who's, is it an open source product?
I think it is, but I think Red Hat have just bought it. I mean, it'll obviously stay open source if they do. It's based on Gentoo as well, which a couple of sort of big things are, like Chrome OS.
See, for some reason in my head, I always thought that Core OS was one of the sort of building blocks of Docker images. But I think I might have been confusing that with Alpine Linux.
Yeah, I think that's Alpine, because Alpine is a very cut down Linux, which you can use. I mean, it's got all the tools that you might need when you build a Docker image. But that's about it.
Right.
And it's just a very lightweight OS on which to put to, or within which to run your app or whatever you want to run in your container.
Mm.
So what have you been up to then, John?
Oh, so that's interesting. So in the day job, I have been working with high available security appliances in OpenStack. Quite a lot of the faffing that I do with OpenStack, particularly early on in the project I've been working on, and now just recently again whilst we've been looking at high availability, is actually in a thing called allowed address pairs. And essentially, OpenStack applies a same origin policy on, I think that's what they call it, on I know it as anti-spoofing from the checkpoint world. But it's effectively the port expects to only see traffic from the IP address and MAC address of the interface that is talking to the network at the time.
Okay.
And obviously when you're deploying a networking appliance into OpenStack, so not an infrastructure piece of OpenStack, but something that's being deployed into the project of OpenStack, that's carrying networking traffic, whether that's a firewall or an IDS or a WAN accelerator or something like that, OpenStack needs to not apply that same origin policy to the port. And that's done by setting a flag in OpenStack called allowed address pairs. Interesting little quirk with OpenStack is that for some reason, with this allowed address pairs object, it doesn't like having a 0000/0 address applied to it. So you have to do it as 2/1. So that's 0000/1 and 128.0.0.0/1.
Oh, interesting.
Slightly random. So that works fine for any multicast, any unicast, any broadcast traffic from that appliance. That's no problem at all. Until you turn on high availability mode on most of these firewalls, because the way that firewalls tend to do high availability is that they either exchange MAC addresses between your active and standby node, or they generate a completely new MAC address and trade that around between whichever one's the active node. I raised a incident with one of our vendors about a month and a half ago and kind of kept prodding at this thing. And it was only last week when they turned around and said, oh, yeah, I forgot to mention, we generate a MAC address for this object when you put it into HA mode. It's like, oh, okay. Nobody thought to mention that to me then. So you can if you're defining something as being HA in OpenStack, you have this 0000/1/128.0.0/1, which is applied against the static MAC address for the object, but then you also have to apply a 0000/1 and 128.0.0.0/1 against the generated MAC address for the cluster. So that then led to quite a lot of investigating the various different vendors that I'm integrating into OpenStack's dynamic MAC address and how they generate it. And that was, it took me 3 days to get the Ansible Ginger templates, because they're huge. I mean, we're talking like 6 lines of Ginger templates just to kind of have all the different permutations of, you know, has this one got a cluster ID? Has this got a virtual system ID? You know, this one's got, so Checkpoint uses a thing called Magic Mac, and FortiGate's got some, oh, it's just ridiculous.
Ginger's not the easiest thing to read either.
So what I found that you can do, because obviously these things are being applied at a playbook level, what you can actually do is you can include out to a templated file. So my playbook for the deployment of this stuff, when you get to the allowed address pairs line, literally the all that is in the playbook is double quotes, curled braces, percent, include, open brackets, apostrophe, and then the path to where this allowed address pairs template is.
Oh, right, that's handy.
So that was fun. The other thing that I found whilst I was doing this, because I spotted that Ansible 2.5 is out, so I updated to Ansible 2.5 and then found that they've
deprecated something you were using.
Yeah, it's a really small thing. It's called with sub-elements.
Oh, right, okay.
So basically, so when you're doing loops in Ansible, you use with something. So it's with items or with dict, which is short for dictionary, or with sub-elements, or...
with nested.
With nested. All of those have now been replaced with a statement, which is loop.
Oh, okay.
So now, instead of looping with a with statement, instead what you do is you do a loop, which is effectively the same as doing with items, and then you can put quotes, curled braces, percent, lookup, and then sub-elements, dicts, nested, or whatever. But there isn't enough examples yet. So I spent ages kind of having to piece around that.
Have they deprecated the other stuff as well?
So they haven't actually deprecated it, but it's deprecated in the documentation. So you have to go, if you want to use with underscore whatever, you have to go and look at the 2.4 documentation or update your Ansible code to be in the 2.5 models. Yeah. Now, the good thing about using the 2.5 models is that they've now got a loop options setting. So when I'm running my playbook at the moment for all of my 2.4 with underscore stuff, for each item it's trying to do in that I'm pulling in from my group files or my other assigned variables, they all end up having like line upon line upon line of JSON data for each instruction that's run. With this loop vars thing, and I'll have to dig out what the actual instruction is and stick it in the show notes, but now you can say effectively name this item, and you can just put in the bits that you want it to render into your loop, so that instead of having like 26 lines for a host, for example, so when my host objects that I provision with Ansible have got all of the networking stuff, and the networking stuff brings with it all of the availability zone stuff, and the availability zone stuff brings with it the routing tables for the availability zone, all that stuff. So you get like a big, literally like 15 lines of text in some cases. And now that's replaced with a single line which says host port. Brilliant. It makes life massively easier, but it does mean going back and rewriting all of my stuff.
Yeah. It's like when you had to suddenly put curly brackets around things used in with items, or and then quotes. I think I spoke to someone at an Ansible conference I went to, and they said they keep things, when they decide to deprecate something, they keep it for two versions or two-point versions. So with items, will probably be gone by Ansible 2.7. But
so, like I said, I don't think it's actually deprecated in the code, because it's so fundamental to the way that Ansible 1. Dot was written and 2. Dot up till now was written. So I suspect that it's probably more likely to be, you know, when you get to 2.8, 2.9, they'll then start notifying people that it's deprecated. But it's like the other thing as well that I've noticed is that where you used to have in your playbooks, you'd have roles, colon, and then a whole list of roles. That's now been deprecated. You're supposed to use include roles or...
import tasks.
Import roles. Yeah. Obviously, it's moaning at me, so I need to go away and fix that stuff at some point as well.
Such a lot of code to change. In a lot of cases, you can search and replace, I think, but still, it's still time needed to do it, isn't it?
But actually, whilst I mention Ansible roles, one of the things that I did note from our deep dive that we did last week into Ansible was that I completely neglected to mention anything about Ansible Galaxy.
I think you did mention a bit about it, just where roles, where other user-contributed roles live.
Yes. So people can contribute roles with Ansible Galaxy. But the thing that Ansible Galaxy that I tend to use it for is really useful for is you can do an Ansible-Galaxy init, and it would generate the boilerplate for the roles that you're creating. And that then means you just need to edit a couple of files and remove stuff, particularly if you're going to then import it in, you know, publish that role. But even if you don't, it's still useful to have it just dump a load of text files into a folder for you without having to really think about it too much.
I've also come across another use in the past couple of weeks. It's that you can use it to install roles. So the command is Ansible Galaxy install, and you can give it a file. And the roles don't have to be user contributed roles from Ansible Galaxy. You can define them as just a Git repo somewhere or something.
And that's quite cool.
You can pull in a load of dependencies based on a text file into some sort of larger project you're doing with Ansible, which is what it's being used for. I think with pip, the Python package manager, you can have a requirements.txt, but in Ansible it's requirements.yaml, and it just literally has the name of the role and then the URL, you know, Git URL or whatever that it can be taken from.
Yeah, right, okay. That's quite cool.
Yeah.
So is that all you've been up to, John? Or is there something else? Was this about your firewall issues?
Oh, yeah. So that's the day job side of things. At night, I've also been experimenting with using... So obviously we use, to promote and to talk to our listeners, we use a thing called Telegram, which is an instant messaging system. But being the free software zealot that I am, although Telegram has an open API and they have open source clients, it's not actually an open source piece of software. And I've been looking at, for about a year and a half now, I've been looking at Riot, which is a client for matrix.org. So it's Riot.im is the client and matrix.org is the server. And one of the nice things about Matrix is that you can actually bridge to other instant messaging systems. So I found a lot of podcasters like Telegram because it's very easy to get people stood up in there. And it's Telegram's got things like stickers and it just feels very easy to use. And particularly Ubuntu podcasters or people that from the Ubuntu community that do podcasting liked Telegram because of its open API, which a lot of the other IM systems didn't have, particularly Signal and WhatsApp don't have open APIs. They still don't have open APIs. But obviously Matrix is a very open system. And one of the things that they've done is introduced bridges to other networks. So Matrix was developed by a telecoms company who were trying to replace the signaling systems that telecoms stuff were using. So a lot of telecoms systems use a thing called SIP to do signaling, and they wanted to basically transition people away from using SIP, which obviously you need to have a device that talks SIP, and you can only have one device that's talking that. There's lots of things around SIP that I don't fully understand. And for me to start trying to explain why this move from SIP to...
I mean, I've heard about SIP in the context of internet telephony.
So the guys that wrote Matrix wanted to move away from using SIP for various reasons, but they wanted to move to another system. So they wrote Matrix. And if you were following any of the Kickstarter stuff earlier this year, to the end of last year, there was a project called the Purism Phone that was intending to replace all of their telephony elements with Matrix, and effectively then using Matrix as the bridge to the different telephony systems. So you would make your voice calls through Matrix to the telephone network. You would send your SMSs as a messaging system from Matrix on your local device to your SMS stack. This is where Matrix is going. But one of the things they did to try and make an attractive platform for people to come to is they started writing bridges. And effectively, a bridge is a way of attaching another IM system into Matrix. So you can attach a Slack bridge from Matrix to present the Slack channel in a Matrix channel. You can bridge from Matrix to IRC. You can bridge from Matrix to Telegram. You can bridge from Matrix to Twitter, although why people would want to do that, I don't know. But the other thing you can do is you can integrate all of these different things. So if you've got people that are dedicated diehard Slack fans, they will use nothing but Slack. Slack is the only thing they will use. And you've also got people that will use Telegram and nothing but Telegram. You can put Matrix in the middle, bridge to Telegram, bridge to Slack. Everyone's talking on the same page. It's really nice. I really like it. The UI is not the best in the world ever, but it's, I really like it. And the fact that it's all open source, it's distributed as well, so I can run my own home server. And in fact, actually, this week, or yesterday as we record, the French government have announced that all of their departments are going to be moving to using Matrix. So instead of using Skype for Business or Telegram or WhatsApp or whatever they previous legacy system, they, I say legacy in quotes, the or previous system they were using, they will all be using Matrix to do their IM.
So do these bridges already exist? So, and also, is there this riot.im, is that the only way of sort of attaching to Matrix?
No, far from it, in fact. Okay, let's answer the bridges question first. The guys that run Matrix run a collection of bridges, and the main ones that they run are the IRC bridges, mostly because it's very difficult to get a random IRC network to bridge to you. So they've got Freenode, and they've got Mozilla's IRC network, and they've got a handful of others.
So when you... this bridge, does that exist? Is that a bit of software that someone is running to physically, not physically, but...
Yes, to logically connect, yes.
Yeah. So it has to be like an instance or there's, it could be a real server or whatever.
Yeah, or a Docker container. So I've not looked into the internals of it, to be fair. So yeah, so the guys that run Matrix run the Matrix server, which is called Synapse, and then they run bridges. And the bridge effectively is like another server. It's like if you ever used IRC and you use things like NickServe or ChanServe or MemoServe or any of those, they're all run on a services server, which does server-to-server communications. The home server, the bit that you actually interact with and you send messages to, that has a connection to this server-to-server service, which is the bridges. So if you were on IRC, so for example, I still use IRC, not a lot, but a little bit. And all of my IRC that's on Freenode, I do through Matrix now.
Personally, I hadn't used IRC. I haven't really used IRC at all. And the first chat client I really used was Slack, and which is probably quite unusual for someone that's been using Linux for so long. But yeah, never really got into IRC.
So can I just roll back a minute? So the Matrix side thing, is that hosted somewhere, or is that something you host yourself?
So there is a reference service, which is matrix.org, and that is hosted by a company called New Vector. It was previously hosted by this telecoms company, but they spun off the Matrix application to New Vector last year. I can host my own Matrix service, and there is a large community of people that do host their own Matrix servers.
And say if you're a company, you could then use Matrix to talk to each other internally. That's what you say.
Yeah. So if I run my own Matrix server and you run your own Matrix server, they will federate and talk to each other. So I don't have to host all of these bridges, for example. You can host them and I trust you. So I can then connect through your federation to your server. In the background, the way that it all works is the same mechanism that Git uses to work out the precedence of commits in a file is the same system that they use to keep all of the federated servers together. So if I tell you that a message has been written and then we lose connection, and somebody on your server posts three messages to the server, and somebody on my end sends three messages to the server. When the connection reestablishes, this Merkle tree is what the proper name for it is. This operation kicks in the background and they synchronize their messages together. And effectively, Matrix is just a distributed database of messages. That's the easiest one way to look at it. It's a distributed database of messages.
By the way, there's a good video on Merkle trees that Computerfile did. So if anyone, we'll put it in the show notes.
Cool. Okay. That's good to know. There's a good video on Matrix, or not video, there's a demonstration of how Matrix's messaging interlink works. So the matrix.org people run this server. I could run my own server. It will then federate, and all the messages that I send and that you send will all join up in the middle and get distributed to everyone else that's part of the federation of chat servers. The bridges, as I said, then hook into the individual federated servers. So Matrix runs a collection. There's a federated service called t2bot.io that runs another collection of bridges. So when I was saying before about you can bridge into Telegram, the bridge to Telegram is done through t2bot.io. And essentially, that's just a collection of bots post messages between servers. Jerry, you also asked about it being the only client. No, far from it. If you go to matrix.2, I think it is from memory, but again, I'll check that out and stick it in the show notes. There is a list of other clients. So Synapse comes with its own command line client, which is apparently a bit rubbish. Riot.im, which has got web, desktop using Electron, Android and iOS clients. But you can also use IRC clients like WeChat. And I think there's even an IRSSI plugin for it as well. So if you're used to using another IRC client, you can swap Matrix in as the back end and it all just works.
So again, does Riot.im, is that hosted or can you host it yourself? Or is it both?
So effectively, it's a static web application that talks to a backend, which is matrix.org. So if I use riot.im, one of the options that I get is which server do you want to talk to? And it's a tick box to change it from being matrix.org to being whatever your hosted service is. And you can then use that. But equally, when I mentioned before about the French government, they are actually, they've forked the riot.im application, and they are making, so one of the things that Matrix has got is that you don't need to enable end-to-end encryption for every chat. It's optional, and once you tick the box that says encrypt, it's encrypt from that point onwards. You can't turn it off again. So I think that one of the things that the French government are doing is making that end-to-end encryption is mandatory on.
Be interested to know if it's GPL, because then the French government would have to publish the changes they made to the source code.
So I don't think it is.
Ah, shame.
I have a feeling that Matrix is Apache licensed. Then again, even if it was GPL licensed, it's not AGPL licensed. So they don't need to make the changes back because they're not distributing them.
Right.
What I'm getting is, so are you using a Riot to do all your or everything into one at the moment then? So you've got everything going into one?
No.
No?
Okay. So I use Telegram, mostly web.telegram.org, for doing Telegram, because to get Telegram bridging working, you need to add a bot into the Telegram channel and then do some synchronization between the two. I use web.whatsapp for my WhatsApp stuff, because apparently that is even more tricky to do. And I would need to be running my own home server to make that work. But for all of my IRC, that's in there. I try not to use Slack very much, but I'm, again, to make Slack bridging work, you need to have the Slack bot added to the channels that you want to use, and that means getting approval from administrators, and I don't run my own Slack instances, so I can't get approval to add the Slack bot to those things. So it's not perfect yet, but I like the matrix.org community and I like the way that they are developing things, and I'd like to see more people moving to it, which is part of the reason why I've given it such a huge plug on this show.
That's what annoys me, when you have so many different messages, different things going on, like WhatsApp, Telegram, SMS, Facebook messages. It gets complicated working out.
Yeah, and they were quite big memory hogs as well, the standalone apps.
So on my phone, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 different IM applications. And that's just on my phone, let alone anything else. So never mind.
It's like, do you remember Trillion in the old days? It was, it spoke all the different simple IM things, like ICQ and AIM and all those.
Yeah. Great minds. Like, I'm literally just Googling it as about 10 minutes ago, thinking, this reminds me of this.
Yeah.
So one of the things that Matrix is trying not to do is it's trying not to be the new XMPP. So part of the reason why they called it Matrix is because it's a matrix of chat environments. It's not just wanting to take all of these different groups and push them all onto Matrix. They want to be able to bridge into other systems. Now, obviously, the walled garden applications like Telegram, like WhatsApp, they don't want that to happen. So, but they're happy to let individuals bridge things in. So, I don't know. It's interesting. I know that there is a libpurple bridge. So libpurple was the library that was used by Pidgin. And Pidgin was another one that would talk everything. So there is a libpurple bridge that means you can then go and talk all the other things that libpurple would talk to connect out. But again, that means running your own home server and hosting your own bridge service to get into those things. All these things that I wish I had time to do. Instead, I'm doing things like podcasting, which is much more fun.
So much to do, so little time.
Indeed.
We've had an email in from since last show from Jeff Owens from the Podnuts Network. He's emailed in saying, I see that PostLayer is no more. Can you recommend any other services? I did a trial last year, but stuck with GFI MaxMail. This is because SolarWinds MS Mail, which is now SolarWinds MSM Mail, it works well for me. Now SolarWinds is moving to Mail Azure. My first client migration failed miserably. They want me to have the client modifying their web settings in order to get it to work. I'm looking for around before I'm trying to migrate to my largest client. So, but if you want to know, so he's asking us what he recommends for emailing spam filtering for your email server. So I've kind of run my own email server since I've had my own domain. Because I never really liked the idea of having a Google mail address or anything like that, because you never know if they get away, you're never going to have access to their email address. So I started off by running Exchange, and then I'm currently running Simbra. But the problem you get is that it's the spam you get through if hosting your own server. So I was when I first started, I was using Pacini, which was then brought out by Google Mail. So I've only got like 4 or 5 users. And the reason we want to do this, the reason you want to be running a postlet or a mail filter or spam filtering is that it doesn't, when someone sends you an email or someone's trying to spam you, if you're hosting your email at home on your DSL connection or something, it's going to take up your bandwidth. So the way I work is that these services work as that they do all the defending for you, and then they send when the messages have been filtered, they send the messages to your mail server.
So do you have to set the MX record for your domain as these services?
Yes.
Okay.
And it means that leave it to the experts, basically, because these things are developing and people are doing spam and things all the different times. People full stop.
Yeah, unless you've got a real interest in that kind of thing, it's better to leave it to someone else. Although it does mean that all your mail's going through these people's servers, but obviously that's the trade-off that you probably have to make.
I mean, if they wanted to work out what I'm doing at the weekend, then so I was using Pacini. Then I moved because then Google brought them out, and they put it in their cloud and it got really expensive. So I then found another company called PostLayer, which was paying $3 per mailbox a year. So I've got 5 mailboxes. So that's $15 a year to protect my email for me. And it also means that because they're the front line, if your email server goes down or your lease or your ADSL goes down, they will stack up your mail until you come online again, and then we'll post the mail free to you. So I was really happy with PostLayer because it just worked. And then they got brought out by a company in America, which now they have put me on another product called FuseMail, which is actually a UK company, but I'm actually buying it through an American company, which is a bit strange. But again, it's still work. I've used FuseMails a lot in the commercial world, and they work really well. Their tech support is really good. You get through to like second, third line guys when you speak to them on the phone. I had an issue where mail wasn't going through correctly, and they were the second and third line guys knew exactly what was causing that. So I recommend, well, I'm currently using FuseMail, and I'm still paying $3 per mailbox. So they got brought out last summer, and it wasn't, so my renewal was in January, and it took me ages to get them to actually give me an invoice to pay for it. I had to chase them to say, hang on, can I pay? Because they basically billed me and said, look, it's going to cost you $15. But there was no way of getting them to pay it. Okay, so you can go online and pay it, but there was an option. So I had a case open for a whole month. But I'm going, I don't want my mail to go down because you need mail. And it ended up having to tweet them to get them to pay them, kind of thing. So it was a tweet. Within an hour, I'd paid it.
That's often the best way of getting customer support these days.
So, I don't know, open source alternatives, but then you have to obviously, if I did open source, you'd have to manage it, but have a separate a VPS in another DigitalOcean box, and then host it yourself, and then you've got to manage it yourself. And
Well, that's not strictly true. So if you're hosting your email on your own server, there's no reason why your SMTP service has to be bound to port 25. So what you could do is bind your, if you're using something like PostFix or SendMail or something like that to receive your emails in, you don't need to bind that to port 25. So you can bind it to something else and then have your mail filtering on port 25. And forwarding it through. That said, whilst I am involved in an organization that does do email forwarding and does do email filtering, which is for log.org.uk, I don't think that's how they do things, partially because they've got enough boxes to be able to spread it out. I do some random things with web hosting where you have the web service running on a different port and then you port forward through Nginx or something like that. So there's no reason why you couldn't do the same thing with your email filtering.
So I don't want to have that kind of traffic going over my internet connection at home. That's all. So
no, I agree. I do agree.
And they don't. And you're not meant to, according to your ISP, not meant to have that port. But I lock that port 25 down so that it only receives connections from the provider.
Right.
So yeah, because it's interesting. Of working for one company, this is like 10, 15 years ago. And they were a health organization, and the amount of spam they've got through, it was taking up loads of their bandwidth. And as soon as we moved them across to like a spam filter, like cut 20% of their bandwidth on their connection. And going back to my bullet journal from last month, it's going quite well. I really, it's really helped me out, kind of thing. I mean, it's a way, but it's a way of making notes and making lists. You meant to do it monthly. So what you meant to do at the start of the month, you meant to make make a massive list of all the things you want to do, and then you meant to plan out your month of what you want to do, so that you've got dates to do those things. And then every day you make notes and you make lists of things you need to do. And then at the end of the month, you meant to go through your lists and work out what you haven't done. But I find a month is just too much for that. So I'm currently doing my bullet journaling is once a week. And it's surprising how much I've actually been more productive. I mean, I've things like putting things off, like getting my mortgage thing sorted out and getting the VPS moved. It's really helped me.
So I must admit, when I was looking at the bullet journaling, I was looking at it and thinking, I already have tasks in Outlook, and I have other tasks in calendar entries on my phone. I archive all my email when I don't need to work with it anymore. So I only have active emails in my email box. So I couldn't see how having a bullet journal kind of worked with that, because everything that I've got is online.
But for me, it's the way my brain works, is that I can have lists and stuff. For me, it's just scheduling things. I now set aside a half an hour on a Sunday evening and work out my next week to make sure what days I'm doing different things. If I don't do it, then it's...
No, that makes sense. It makes sense to do it that way. If that's the way your brain works, then yeah, it makes sense to do it that way.
Because I can start doing this. I always kind of like do things like the Trello boards and the other things. And this is the only thing that seems to have worked really well so far. And to me, I don't know what it is in my brain, is that if I write something out again, it makes more sense. If it's on the screen and I read it, it doesn't sink in. But if I write it down again, it kind of gets in my brain. Anything else to discuss or anything else to bring up?
Well, we've got events to mention. Actually, before we do anything, we should give a big thank you to Dave for doing our audio production on the show, because we haven't really mentioned him since when he started doing it. So thanks, Dave.
We should say we kind of ummed and ahed about it at the end of last show, whether we should have mentioned it in the show. And whilst he was listening to it, he said, I heard you talking about it and you don't need to do it, because, you know, that's not why I do it. But actually, so I've known Dave for 8 or 9 years, and he's such a genuinely really nice gentleman that and having him involved in this project as well just made me being involved in this just so much better. So thank you, Dave.
And also the show sounds a lot better because of him.
Yes.
And if it doesn't, we include an apology at the beginning of the show.
And we'll put a link into his podcast, which the Budcast, which you should all go and check out.
So as well as Dave doing our audio production, which is fantastic, we have some other things that we've been mentioning over the last few months. So the first one is FOSS Talk Live, which is on the 9th of June at King's Cross in London. And if you want to find out more about that, go to fosstalk.com. That's Foxtrot Oscar Sierra Sierra Tango Alpha Lima Kilo.com. There is also the Glasgow Pod Crawl, which is on Saturday, the 28th of July. And there is a URL for that. Well, there will be a URL for that in the show notes. And the last thing to mention is Og Camp, which is on the 18th and 19th of August in Sheffield. And for more details about that, go to Og Camp Oscar Golf Golf Charlie Alpha Mike Papa.org. So that's ogcamp.org.
And hopefully see you there.
Yeah, I'm trying to get my on-call swapped so that I can go.
That'd be really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose it'd be quite ironic if your on-call rotor got in the way, being an admin of going to Og Camp.
The thing I was going to say before we go is, if I want to get the podcast out there a bit more, and I think the best way is to get the podcast out there, is that if you could, the listener, recommend it to this podcast to someone else, that would be great to get the listener numbers up.
Yes, So I've definitely heard that if you can go to iTunes, if you listen to this on iTunes, if you can go to iTunes and leave a review, that ups our visibility.
Even if you don't listen to it on iTunes, go to, if you've got a Mac, it's probably easier, go to iTunes and leave a review.
Yeah, because annoyingly you have to be in the app to do it.
Yeah. Isn't it called Apple Podcasts now? I don't know, I haven't got an Apple device.
But I have done a banner for the podcast, so we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, with showing us about it, what the podcast is, kind of thing.
Cool.
So, yeah, for further ado, we'll see you next time.
See you later.
Until next time.
Bye for now.